south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, as Ed Sullivan would say, we have a really big shoe for you today. Though really, how many of you actually remember old Eddie Sullivan? I can date myself when I say we all sat around and watched the Beatles' first performance on Ed Sullivan in 64. I was a little squat, but I remember, along with Tiny Tim, Topo Gigio, and of course those famous plate spinners. Whatever happened to those guys? What a way to make a living, huh? Which brings up an interesting point. I saw a bumper sticker the other day. It said, "Stop making no-talent people famous." I guess they were referring to the retired Ashians. And every rapper and reggaetonero in existence, too. But hey, that's not a modern 21st century phenomena. I mean, look at Ed Sullivan, the biggest variety TV show of all time. And the guy had absolutely zero talent. For those of you who remember, his delivery was so wooden and so mechanical. He just had no flair for anything. So how'd he get the job? Was it nepotism? Who knows? Before his really big shoe, he was a New York Times columnist. Which just goes to show people without an ounce of talent, like the biggest, smelliest chunks of in the toilet, do sometimes float to the top. That's a rock-solid rule in politics, by the way. But you knew that already, right? By the way, Latinas and Latinos have no idea who Ed Sullivan was, nor Johnny Carson or Conan or even Oprah. They have their own Spanish-language hosts and hostesses, even more bland and less talented than most that float to the top of the toilet bowl in the States. Which brings us to the point of this little rant. The other day, I was sitting around with some 20 and 30-something Latinas and a handsome 30-something Latino guy with a very nicely trimmed, very short beard. The TV was on and tuned to a popular Latin American talk show. Kind of like a Latin American version of a Judge Judy show. Hey, you've heard me say this before. Everything, and I mean everything, in Latin American media and television is a bad copy of everything good, bad, and ugly in American entertainment media. So anyway, on this show, there was the Latin version of Judge Judy, and the two people fighting it out in TV court were a pregnant lady and her mega-tattooed ex-boyfriend sporting ass-crack pants. It was just pathetic. By the way, that's something that until recently you could never get away with on TV, here or up in the States. People, supposedly normal people, wearing ass-crack pants. Anyway, this show was about the usual suspect domestic themes. The guy was apparently doing his wife's sister on the side. And later they brought her in too, and that's when the fireworks started. But who really cares, right? The thing is, the guy in question had a look that drives me nuts. He's got no chance of ever growing a real mustache or a beard, yet he somehow thinks it's ever so cool to sprout two scraggly facial hairs, both fighting with a big old mole for face space. To me, it's just the most ridiculous thing. A guy who's got absolutely no chance of growing a decent mustache or a beard, somehow thinking he's a real man if he just lets his two or three hairs grow wild. I mean, honestly, who does that impress? So I said to the three ladies and the handsome Latino guy sitting there, look at that guy's facial hair. Doesn't his wife, girlfriend, or even his mother bother to give him a heads up on how awful that looks? I said, I would never embarrass myself. That's the reason why I haven't grown a beard or a mustache. I've got some spotty patches myself, which is probably a good thing in the long run because a razor blade lasts me a long, long time. Whereas for a couple of my Italian friends back in Chicago, some of them a while back anyway, would complain to me, especially the guys that were executive types and had to suit up and have the corporate look. Those guys would tell me what a pain in the ass it was to have to shave in the morning and later around 5 o'clock, you know, this 5 o'clock shadow thing. Though now, at least in the last 10 years or so, my hair sweet buddies up in the States are living in the glory years because, you know, the 5 o'clock shadow thing is all the rage. And though it may be scratchy and irritable to us, as expat Eddie says, chicks dig it. But do they? Really? That's the question I posed to those three Latinas and handsome Latino, sitting there watching the guy with more moles than hair on his face, stroking his chin like a philosophy professor. And guess what? I don't know if North American ladies feel the same way, but these Latina girls agreed. A guy who cultivates a spottier, scraggly beard is just not adding any points to his score. Though, you know, millions of guys do it. It's a macho testosterone-driven thing, of course. Though it is surprising to note that ladies don't find it attractive, And ironically, that's why guys cultivate those things, to try to show their manly appeal to the opposite sex. Now, you probably all knew that already. However, those ladies set me straight on a few things I didn't know. For one, they almost all like a nice, closely cropped beard, but no neck hair. All three of them said, why do guys do that? They run the neck hair all the way down to the chest hair. All three of them said they really prefer guys who have it trimmed up to the bottom of the jawline. And guys sprouting nose and ear hair, that was pretty disgusting to all three of the ladies too. Yep, and during that discussion, I remembered the famous words of expat Eddie. He said, show me a guy with tufts of ear or nose hair, and I'll show you a guy whose girlfriend's not in love with him anymore. In other words, it's a clue, expat Eddie says, when it comes to guys who can sprout that kind of hair. Whether the guy's in a good relationship, therefore getting lovingly pruned by his better half or not. Oh, and then the topic got around to chest hair. And again, all three of them said they don't like it. Oh, and another thing that really surprised me, all three of them said they don't mind at all if a guy's got a little pot belly. Not too excessive, but a pot belly's okay. According to them, a guy loses no points at all if he's a couple of cans short of a six-pack. Oh, they like a guy with a six-pack, all right, but a guy who doesn't have one, has a little pot belly, absolutely A-okay. Well, that should be good news for, I think, about 98% of guys out there. So what can we gather from all this? Well, when it comes to Latin American ladies, and I think it's probably universally true, if you're looking for a leg up in the mating, dating, and romance department, spend less time going for that six-pack, and do pay attention to the nose, ear, and neck hair. And if you can't grow a decent beard, don't even think about trying. So there you have it, another Living in Latin America tidbit. You're just not going to read in International Living or on any expat blog. And now, drum roll, please. A word about water filters and solar panels. Just kidding. Now, you longtime listeners know that once in a while I make fun of low-budget backpackers and skinflint gringos and expats who make it obvious, even brag about, pinching pennies. Well, today a longtime listener comes to the defense of expat gringo tightwads. In fact, he entitles his little tome, In Defense of the Low-Budget Expat. He starts out, Dear Johnny, you've got great practical, info-laden shows lately, and thanks mucho, but as a decade-long listener to your show, I might point out one glaring weakness in your podcast. You've got a decided intolerance of pretentious, know-it-all listener feedback, and I've noticed you've got some crusading Plan B denialists immune to doing their own basic research, meaning boots on the ground. Maybe it's because they want to make sure their belly buttons are eternally lint-free and want someone else to do the work. I've noticed some people who write to you are braggart sub-morons who are absolutely sure they know it all and have Latin America all figured out. That, after spending maybe at most 6 months in a Latin country. Though I admit to a slight guilty pleasure to your occasional and usually even-handed skewering of such buffoons, though we've all committed probably more than a few boners in life sometimes too, and deserve to be called out on it. I notice your listeners seem to span a wide socioeconomic spectrum. But I'd like to embolden the lower economic class of folks who listen to you. In other words, not to get disheartened about trying to pull off a Latin relocation plan, a Plan B. You know what they say, where there's a will, there's a way, especially if a person's clever enough and well-researched. I'm a classic example of that, he says. At age 40, I was medically bankrupted by a case of stage 4B cancer. I survived. And therefore went the simple life path after that and stepped off the formal mainstream work path and have lived on a micro budget now bolstered by a modest Social Security check, though that too is soon to be destroyed by government treachery, but that's another story. Then he says, yet I migrated to Latin America 7 years ago and have lived a contented country life here ever since. I've had proper regular dental care, the occasional doctor visit, and even a surgical operation in my little Altiplano paradise here in Latin America. I've got my van in tip-top shape from a local ace mechanic that I trust. I've got a healthy organic diet, inexpensively sourced at local markets, and even a well-appointed wood shop for my various projects. My country house here, Johnny, is modest and outfitted with simple but effective systems. For example, a well, a $6 a month power bill, and my rent a whopping $120 a month. Sure, there's goats and driveway chickens giving me wake-up calls at sunrise, but that's no extra charge. And I've got real friendly neighbors. While I've seen a good bit of Latin America over the years, Mexico has been fine for me so far, even as it slowly slides into a failed state. And I know it's not good for the writing on the wall for long-term living here. I could afford residency income requirements in some Latin countries, and choosing to reside in Mexico has required a once every 6 months border run to Guatemala for a quick in and out to get a fresh new Mexican 6 month tourist visa. Though that too is sadly drawing to a close in Mexico due to a better national database management system. Though it is very possible to do that kind of thing in other less developed Latin countries. I mean those quickie border runs every 90 or 180 days. In short, new expats and gringos coming down and fearing crashing and burning once they're here should be tempered with realizing those chances are minimal if properly planned and executed. After all, resources like your show, Johnny, are out there to lay the groundwork for a successful relocation. I admit, listening to your podcast a few years before deciding to drive down with all my worldly possessions was a great benefit. That and some other great web contents out there. And in my case, I did some other Latin American traveling in my wild and woolly youth. It's true that the USSA, formerly USA, is about to be a terminal impact zone. It's far better to migrate to the much freer countries south of the border, while you still can. As far as gonna-bes, wannabes, and procrastinators, I do have good friends who've delayed retirement in Gringoland for fear of the unknown. They're uncertain about what lies outside of their cages, even though the door is wide open, at least for now. The same thing goes for the millions of others of Plan B fence-sitters who just have not or will not pull the trigger. So here's to hoping those afraid of not being able to afford a relocation step outside of their cage, here's to hoping they'll see the light and realize down here, it's much more free and the quality of life here south of the border is undeniably better. And lastly, Johnny, I'd like to finally sing the praises of longtime Expat Files character, Expat Eddie. After a decade of hearing of his exploits, he's now sort of painted solidly in our imaginations. From his predilection to sticking it to government slugs and bureaucrats, to saving ladies in distress by punching out macho thugs, and his own personal hard work, rags-to-riches story in Latin America. Beneath Eddie's seemingly tough exterior, there's a kind guy who'd most certainly be canceled and dissed by the Twitter mob had he remained up in the States. Being the jaded and flawed anti-hero that he is, it seems though he always does do the right thing in the end and knows the value of loyalty to his friends. But also, due to Eddie's apparent overall tendency to anonymity, my assessment of him might be total BS, who knows. Nevertheless, it's certainly been fun to hear of his tales over the years. That said, that's it for today, Johnny. Best wishes from Oaxaca, Mexico. Signed, Bob G., defender of low-budget expats. Well, thanks for that, Bob. That just might knock a few people off the fence. Though I'm beginning to think some gonna-bes and wannabes have been on the fence so long. They've got the top rail of the fence permanently stuck in the crack of their ass. And that's not a good look. You know, my good old German mom once told me of a family that she knew. They lived on the same block as the Berlin Wall, on the East German side of Berlin. And every once in a while in the dead of the night, they'd hear some soft rustling outside, knowing people were sneaking through their yard making a break for it. Now, of course, everyone in that family could see West Berlin, you know, the free side, through the windows. They saw the stark difference between a free and highly developed capitalist society and a communist society on the East side. Oh, that family wanted to escape in a big way, too. But in that 40 years the wall existed, no one in the family ever took the chance to get the hell out. Even though in that 40 years they saw hundreds of people risking everything to get on through. And they knew how to do it. They knew the guards' schedules, the shift changes, the coffee and bathroom breaks. They knew which guards were strict and who were lazy asses, the way the searchlights worked. They knew the areas of minimal coverage, the dead spots. They had 100 chances to slip out, but they never did. So many opportunities lost. All right, now some very sad news. One of my good expat friends who's been down here almost as long as I have just passed away this week. Now, all you guys who came to my earlier Expat Insider seminars will surely remember him, because up to just about 3 years ago, I took everyone from the seminar into his factory. Yeah, I know, they call them sweatshops down here, but believe me, his factories were anything but sweatshops. My seminar guys and gals remember him as quite a character. We'd go into his factory, he'd take us on a tour, show us all the things his ladies were making. Yep, his factory was about 98% women, as it should be. He's the one who always told me you have to keep the male population of workers down to the bare minimum because male workers always bother the ladies. It's that macho gene. We've discussed that before. Anyway, he was quite a guy, half Canadian, half American, but mostly raised in New York. Yep, he was one of those garment district guys that came down to Latin America, opened a couple factories, and pumped out designer clothes and other items like belts, purses, bras, shoulder pads, etc. Anyway, he was a good friend of mine for a long, long time. And then when this COVIDiot thing hit, we didn't see too much of each other. Last we spoke was about 4 months ago. Then, just a few days ago, Bitcoin Dan, also a buddy of his, gave me the bad news. In the end, it's worth pointing out a few details. Like most all of us long-term expats, he had great insurance. And he always had great luck down here with first-world hospitals and clinics for the usual routine general stuff. But here's the thing. A month or so ago, when he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, he thought, like most Americans do, most Americans living up in the States anyway, he wanted the best hospital that specialized in cancer. And one of the best is Sloan Kettering in New York. You've probably heard of it. He went there and got radiation and chemo. And from what his son tells me, they somehow blew a hole in or screwed up his intestines, and he died from that, not the cancer. So in the end, traditional medicine failed him, but he was that kind of guy. Like most Americans, he believed in traditional medicine. Before the diagnosis, he went back to the States and got vaxxed. And, well, what can I say? We lost a good one there. Oh, and by the way, even up to the last time I talked to him a couple months ago, he was saying, Johnny, next time you have a seminar, bring him through the factory again. He liked seeing my groups as much as they liked seeing him. He had tons of great stories, especially since over the years he had clothing factories in Jamaica, Honduras, Costa Rica, even early on in the Middle East. But he always swore that the best workers he ever had were Guatemalans. Not because they were so much more productive or faster than other Latin Americans, but mostly, he said, because his factories were in the Altiplano. He said conditions in the Altiplano were perfect for workers. Thus, his factories were always airy and cool. He'd say, no sweat, no sweatshop. Unlike factories in Costa Rica, Honduras, Nicaragua, Belize, etc., that were smack dab in the tropical heat. He said, no one could afford to air condition a giant factory in the sun-drenched tropics, basically at sea level. Under those conditions, workers couldn't help but suffer. He knew for a fact, and he'd say it all the time, Guatemalan workers in the Altiplano were the most productive workers he ever had. So farewell to a good buddy. He was 65. By the way, he survived by his wife, a lady Guatemalan lawyer, and one very smart, completely bilingual kid, a son, who just graduated from a helicopter high school this week. Oh, and I almost forgot. Last time I talked to my buddy, he told me he was digging through some really old files, and out popped an American Express traveler's check for $50. I thought, man, does anyone remember traveler's checks? They can't still exist. He said it expired. It was way beyond its expiration date of about 28 years. Hey, I remember using them when I first started traveling around in my 20s. Of course, that was before the internet, smartphones, debit cards, even before the massive penetration of credit cards, where every high school graduate got 1, 2, or 10 in the mail without even applying for them. Just fill out the form and we'll send you the card. For some reason, I never took them up on it, but my buddies did. But not me. Why? Because I saw my dad get way over his head in credit card debt. Anyway, we're talking about traveler's checks now. There's obsoletus pagers. Remember those? That's why people who diss Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies make me laugh. Way back when, people said telephones were just a toy for rich people. Electricity in the days of Tesla, too. Oh, and did you know that J.P. Morgan's personal residence was the first one in all the United States to have electric lights? Radio, too. They said that was just a toy for rich people, as was TV. Oh, and remember, the chairman of IBM once said, the world would only need a couple of hundred big computers owned by governments, big banks, and such. Same thing with the internet. Normal people, even intelligent normal people, laughed at the internet when it first came out. Those telephone modems were so damn slow. By the way, here's something I'm sure you never heard before. Do you know why the electricity that comes into your home is 60 cycles? 60 hertz, that's 60 pulses per second. Well, that's another thing we can thank Tesla for. No, not the car company. I'm talking Nikola Tesla. Well, you see, when he developed his AC generator and AC motors, and they were first coming out and ready to sell to the public, they had to be compatible with the wiring already in people's houses. Back then, when people had their houses wired, it was just for lights. That's all. That was the first use of electricity in the house. With Edison's DC system, there were only lights. There were no good DC motors. They had brushes that wore out and sparked. Plus, they stunk up the air with ozone. So there weren't any electric washing machines, vacuum cleaners, etc. Not till Tesla's AC system came along. and his brushless AC motors. This is around the year 1895, so he became partners with Westinghouse, and they were working on what would be the best way to efficiently run power to a house with AC, alternating current, where motors would be efficient and lights wouldn't flicker. They settled on 60 cycles and began manufacturing generators and motors for trains, pumps, appliances, etc. The thing is, the slower your generator rotated, the longer it would last, the less heat it would produce. In those days, a fast-spinning motor or generator would get hot and wear out fast. So, within a decade, 60 cycle became the U.S. standard. That means the generator producing the electricity at the power plant, the rotor has to spin 60 times a second. Now, you can speed those things up, but you get a lot more wear and tear and heat. And the speed could be lowered too, like in Europe, where they have a 50 cycle standard. The thing is, though, some people with very acute eyes actually see the flicker of lights at 50 and 60 cycle. Most people don't, I don't, but people with very good eyesight, like some professional hitters, baseball players, are bothered by the flicker that most people never see, and they get unexplained headaches. Oh, and there's another amazing coincidence when Tesla and Westinghouse picked 60 cycles. The first electric clocks, and for many years thereafter, were easily synced to 60 cycle current coming directly from the generator. Perfect for timekeeping as long as the rotor at the generator spun exactly at 60 cycles. You know, there's 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, etc., etc. Perfect and dead easy to synchronize a clock. Problem is, though, those massive generators producing the power slowed down just a bit under heavy loads. Like at night, when most people had their electric lights on, the generator might drop down to 59 or 58 cycles, and all the electric clocks would run just a little bit slow. Not much, but a little bit. And that was the state of things until about 1920. Generators got very stable, spinning exactly at 60 cycles, no matter what the load. By the way, it was Tesla, too, that developed a governor, another one of his 400 patents, to put on those big generators so they ran exactly in sync. That is, precisely at 60 revolutions or 60 cycles a second. But what that meant was, in Europe, they couldn't synchronize electric clocks directly to the power generators because they were spinning at 50 cycles. Yep, for some reason, the power generation people in Europe picked 50 cycles. It took a decade or so for them to figure out some cheap electronics to have their electric clocks synced up in Europe on 50 cycles. Of course, these days, all the LED lights you see everywhere are running on DC. There's no flickering at all. The voltage is dead steady. Hey, am I boring you with this stuff? Sorry about that. But you know, being an engineer, I sometimes veer off into oddball, but amazing to me anyway, digressions. By the way, if you've ever read a biography about Tesla or heard any funny stories about him, I wonder if you knew that some people thought he was an alien from another planet, even back in the 1890s up through the 1920s. In fact, in his own autobiography, he wrote, quote, "I would not touch the hair of another person except perhaps at the point of a revolver. I can't look at certain foods, for example, peaches, without getting physically sick." He said, "I cannot tolerate earrings on women." In his own words, he said, "The sight of a pearl earring would almost give him a fit." He also said he would count the steps when he walked, making sure they were divisible by three. Almost everything in his physical world was divided by three. He felt compelled to repeat that exercise over and over, compulsively too. In fact, at each meal as an adult, he demanded 9 or 18 napkins, a number, again, divisible by three. And he wiped down each plate, bowl, and piece of silverware. Do we know anybody like that? Sound familiar? Obviously, he was one of the very first written about, anyway, germaphobes. He was also absolutely obsessed with mathematically calculating oddball things. Like, for example, if he was sitting at a table, he'd calculate the volume of soup plates, coffee cups, even pieces of food. Oh, and by the way, we all know that name Tesla now from Elon Musk and Tesla cars, right? It really is a cool and fitting name, isn't it? So elegant, short, simple, and rolls right off the tongue, huh? However, here's what people don't know. That word in Serbian, because he was a Croatian Serb, the name Tesla means, get this, a person with protruding teeth, a buck-tooth guy, which, as it turns out, was a true trait of several of his notable ancestors. That's how in the olden days, lots of people got the family names. You know, Thatcher, that's a guy who built thatched roofs. Mr. Farmer, that's self-evident. Smith, that's a guy who worked metal, a metalsmith. Though I'd much rather be called Mr. Thatcher than Mr. Bucktooth. So think about that next time you're at a red light and a Tesla pulls up. But I digress. Man, did I digress. All right, now a short but pertinent email from Mr. C. He says, Johnny, can you tell us about off-the-books jobs for gringos versus on-the-books jobs? Does it matter if someone is on disability in the States and receiving a check? Would that disability income be affected by having an on-the-books job in, let's say, Guatemala or anywhere else in Latin America? Oh, and Johnny, have you heard of any new kinds of jobs for gringos and expats, especially since the helicopter school teaching jobs have pretty much dried up due to the COVID thing? And finally, Johnny, did you know that Gerald Celente owns property on the most historic four corners in the U.S.? Ah, Mr. C, you mentioned Gerald Celente. I love the guy, except he's such a name dropper. I know we've all got faults. I got a million myself. But it seems every single interview he gives, he has to mention that he owns houses on the most historic four corners in the U.S. God, do we have to hear that again? And of course, he always slips in the fact that he was the youngest guy to ever have a certain political flunky job in the New York state government. Like anyone really gives a rat's ass. Gerald, we love your content, but we don't need to hear about that other stuff ad nauseum, please. And as for Mr. C's inquiry about on and off the books jobs in Latin America, the thing is, Mr. C, if you have an on the books job, you'll be registered with the tax and revenue people in whatever Latin country, and its income, it's registered and can be checked. So you will have to report that on your U.S. income tax forms. And as you probably well know, you can supplement your Social Security or disability income and not pay any penalties or lose any benefits. But once you hit a certain level, they start reducing the payouts. The IRS has charts and tables for that. You can look it up on their website. Of course, when you're off the books, that's what it means. You're off the books and you're getting paid in cash or driveway chickens. Now, if you're one of those guys or gals who's pure as the driven snow, you'll report that income on your U.S. tax form too, but there will be no way for anyone to check on it. Which is why for so many gringos and expats, working off the books is what they really prefer doing. That's why so many gringos and expats have internet businesses and a bank account registered in an SA corporation. So the income from that business flows into the bank account that's registered in the corporation and not under their name. And of course, everything is legal and on the up and up in the Latin country that you're in, though, according to U.S. tax law, in some cases, it's not necessarily legal. Best thing to do is to get with your own Latin lawyer on that issue. They know the ins and outs and all the angles. The thing is, though, out of every 100 gringos making money here in Latin America, I'd say other than teaching English in a helicopter school, only maybe 5% or even less are working on the books as an employee of a Latin business. The vast majority are making money somehow off the books.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos. Latin.